1, 2, 3, 4.
Today, as we move towards 2026, we are in a massive upgrade moment that most of us can feel. New pressures, new identities, new expectations on our work, our relationships, and our inner lives. Throughout the year, I've been speaking with professional creatives, climate and tech experts, teachers and neuroscientists, psychologists and futurists about how AI can be used intelligently and ethically as a partnership to ensure that we do not raise a generation that relies on machines to think for them. It's not that we are being replaced by machines, it's that we are being invited to become a new kind of human. Where AI isn't the headline, human transformation is. And that includes the arts, culture, and the whole of society. Generative AI, the technologies that write our emails, draft our reports, and even create art, have become a fixture of daily life. The philosophical and moral questions they raise are no longer abstract. They are immediate, personal, and potentially disruptive to the core of what we consider human work. Our guest today, Sven Nyholm, is helping us navigate this new reality as the principal investigator of AI ethics at the Munich Center for Machine Learning and co-editor of the journal Science and Engineering Ethics. He has spent his career dissecting the intimate relationship between humanity and the machine. His body of work systemically breaks down concepts that worry us all: the responsibility gap in autonomous systems, the ethical dimensions of human-robot interaction, and the question of whether ceding intellectual tasks to a machine fundamentally atrophies our own skills. His previous books, like Humans and Robots, Ethics, Agency, and Anthropomorphism, have laid the foundational groundwork for understanding these strange new companions in our lives. His forthcoming book is The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence, A Philosophical Introduction. The book is a rigorous exploration of everything from algorithmic bias and opacity to the long-term existential risks of powerful AI. We'll talk about what it means when an algorithm can produce perfect language without genuine meaning, why we feel entitled to take credit for an AI's creation, and what this technological leap might be costing us personally as thinking, moral beings. Professor Sven Nyholm, welcome to The Creative Process.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the program. Looking forward to discussing this. It's important for us all, whether we are working in the university like I am, or whether we are students at the university or have nothing to do with the university. It's a topic that no one can escape from.
Exactly. In fact, we're already in conversation with student groups and faculty across campuses to discuss ways that the rise of AI doesn't have to mean the decline of creativity and critical thinking. And I think universities now have a unique opportunity to shape a future in which students leverage AI thoughtfully, retain deep knowledge, and innovate independently. And you know this as a professor of AI ethics, and I believe every student learns best when their curiosity is sparked. There's that active dialogue, their individuality is honored, and their creativity nurtured. And that's what makes knowledge memorable and lasting and stays with you beyond university. That's the kind of spirit we try to bring to our work. So I'm just going to ask you, a big doorstop question to get the conversation going. You know, OpenAI started as a nonprofit, but soon they say it's going to be a $1 trillion company. Data centers are being built in rural America without anyone knowing who the owners are. Estimates by the global consulting firm McKinsey and Company say global spending on AI data centers will total nearly $7 trillion by 2030. Some companies like Elon Musk's XAI have added huge temporary methane gas generators to supply additional energy to their facilities, and in data center heavy regions across the US, plans to decommission coal plants have been delayed to keep electricity flowing. So we have all this competition for energy, and research analysts for Goldman Sachs say they expect the proliferation of AI technology and the data centers necessary to feed it to drive an increase in power demand, the likes of which hasn't been seen in a generation. Okay, on top of that, we've got climate change.
I was reading the other day in The Guardian about a farmer who bought land for under $200,000 and then was offered by a tech company, he thinks, $10 million. The representatives for the buyers wouldn't say who their clients were, so he refused to sell, and they eventually found somebody else
to sell their land for a data center. So it's obvious the AI boom is the new gold rush in America and around the world. And in the Nevada desert, as one of the places where the greatest expansion for big tech data centers is taking place, Google, Apple, Tesla, Microsoft, as I said, pouring this $7 trillion into AI data centers. We don't have the statistics on the spending from around the world. We can only speculate. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, obviously not
doing this out of the goodness of their heart, you know. And we see the Trump administration has gone all in on the rapid advancement of AI rollout without restrictions, going back on what Biden tried to set up in terms of guardrails, you know, without insights into the effects AI can have on arts, culture, and society, how we communicate with each other and how we communicate with ourselves. We've already seen what 20 years being on social media has done to the political landscape, our internal emotional landscape, and young people growing up living their life through screens, social anxiety, eco-anxiety, loss of self-worth, massive loneliness. So what do you foresee happening over the next two decades with AI, which is, you know, I believe a far more powerful and persuasive tool than social media?
Yeah, so exactly this issue I discuss it within my book coming out soon, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence, A Philosophical Introduction. And I call this the AI wager. I think we're betting on AI as something that can help to solve a lot of problems for us. It's the future, we think, whether it's producing text or art or doing medical research or planning our lives for us, etc. The bet is that AI is going to be great, that it's going to get us everything we want, so to speak, and make everything better. But at the same time, we're gambling with, at the extreme end, with the future of humanity. I mean, there are those, including very successful AI researchers such as Geoffrey Hinton, just recently got a Nobel Prize for his work in AI, who I seriously worry that AI can have disastrous consequences, that we're going to lose control over AI and that we may end up harming ourselves in the process. Less perhaps dramatic versions of that relates to what you mentioned, namely these enormous data centers that use up so much energy, that use so much water to cool down these very hot computer systems. The natural resources that are needed to build all this technology that maybe are not replenished as quickly as they're used up, so to speak. When we're betting on AI being good and important enough that it's going to be worth it, so to speak, that we're not doing a bad gamble. Where are we going to go in the future? Well, it's hard to predict. We're seeing a lot of, every now and then, these sort of quick developments where things seem to just take off. For example, with the release of ChatGPT and other large language model-based chatbots and other forms of generative AI, suddenly there appeared, at least to the general public, to be an enormous leap forward. The question is going to continue in an equally rapid way into the future? And if so, are we steering the ship, so to speak, in a safe and careful way? Or are we being reckless? Are we driving the car, so to speak, while blindfolded and while drunk and intoxicated with the idea of getting to where we want to go? Or are we driving in a careful and slow way, buckled up and, you know, taking all the precautions? Probably somewhere in between those two. Even the big tech companies have people working on what they call AI safety. And the big tech companies also hire colleagues of mine to work on ethics and AI. I just saw actually the other day that Google DeepMind are hiring new people. They already have a big group of researchers working on this topic. So there are attempts to put up safety risk mitigation measures, guardrails, etc. But we're sort of pushing ahead as quickly as possible and gambling with the future of our society, with stability, etc. Hoping for the best and hoping that this, what I'm calling the AI wager, is going to work out to our advantage. But we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes I wonder, I mean, I always want to maintain hopeful. I'm actually a very hopeful person because of just listening and learning from people who've given it a lot of thought and others involved. I don't know if your research was involved in helping author the EU AI Act, but sometimes I feel like those measures of the big tech companies, obviously to hire philosophers and others from the humanities to consider the full dimensions, maybe kind of covering your, I don't want to say ass tactic, you know, damage limitations. So, you know, for us in Europe, thinking about Peter Thiel placed J.D. Vance in Trump's hands and suggested him as a candidate for vice president, and Elon Musk gave $300 million to Trump's re-election campaign. So we see the power tech bros are having on society and politics today. And we know, we've seen there's some extreme right-wing views. At London's massive Unite the Kingdom anti-immigration rally led by Tommy Robinson, Elon Musk addressed over 100,000 protesters via video, urging regime change in the UK and warning that violence is coming if mass migration continues. You know, he blamed the political left for the nation's slow destruction, as he called it, denounced the woke mind virus, and called for new elections. Musk's speech dominated the far-right rally, which saw violent clashes, leaving 26 police officers injured and dozens arrested, while politicians and anti-racism groups condemned his remarks. So now with AI in the hands of these people, do you feel they're the good stewards for the future of humanity and civilization? What can we in Europe do to counteract this and retain our values, which I think are slightly different than in America?
Absolutely. And also, whether one is a Trump supporter or the opposite, whether one is worried about the way that the US is going or not, it was very striking that when Trump was inaugurated as president, the most well-known figures from the tech industry were also there in the room, sometimes taking more prominent seats in the inauguration ceremony than some of the members of the cabinet. And normally one would have think would have sort of sat closest to the president when he was inaugurated as the new president. And you talk about donations and indeed, and people in the tech world influencing governments. It's not only the American government, other governments too are being courted by the tech industry who are hoping to relax regulations perhaps, or maybe hoping for there to be regulations that fit with their ends and goals, etc. So you were asking what can we do over here in the European Union or in Europe to counteract this. There's something called the Brussels effect one sometimes talks about. The EU is trying to create all sorts of regulations and hoping that even though the US and China are perhaps the two most advanced AI powers in terms of the technology development, a lot of people here in the European Union and Europe in general are hoping that we can sort of be the forerunners when it comes to responsible AI and incorporating AI into society in a kind of responsible way. Certainly the GDPR that had influence outside of Europe, the EU AI Act you mentioned, that is also something that we're hoping will inspire different parts of the world to adopt similar guidelines. To just mention the Chinese case, I mean, they are also working a lot on AI ethics and AI guidelines. You mentioned that values differ in different parts of the world. I would say yes and no. Actually, if you look at some of the AI ethics guidelines that are formulated in the Chinese context, there's a lot of overlap with what you would expect in the European context. Some colleagues of mine looked at, I believe, 80 or 90 or something like that, AI ethics guidelines from all sorts of different organizations, governmental or organizations of other kinds, research institutions, government organizations, and private entities. A lot of the general principles that are formulated will sound quite similar, and we can all kind of agree on them. A lot of the disagreement, I think, when it comes to AI ethics and AI guidelines and policy, etc., comes to how do you sort of put this into practice and how do you interpret values such as, let's say, freedom or equality? And also, how do you balance these values? I mean, how much, let's say, inequality are you willing to tolerate in order to have more freedom, to innovate, to experiment? Or the other way around, how important it is it to give everyone a voice and create a democratic process? Well, if that's the aim, then perhaps the tech industry has to, you know, not get too much space to operate in an unconstrained sort of way. So we're hoping to set a good example with good and well-formulated and well-thought-out rules and regulations, legal and ethical frameworks. Of course, there's a discussion on an abstract level. As I said, we can perhaps all agree to some extent on certain values and certain ethical principles. I mean, who is against human dignity? Who is against promoting people's welfare? And who wants to impose suffering on others sort of unnecessarily, etc.? It's going to be hard to find people who say that, yeah, I'm completely opposed to all of those values. But when it comes to sort of putting this into practice, asking what it actually means, to what extent can we force either users of AI, regular people, or the tech companies developing the technologies, to what extent can we control the business model, etc.? There you're going to have a lot of disagreement. And also, are we ultimately looking to use AI in our everyday life to do things such as making shopping lists or making purchases online or having a chatbot companion or perhaps even a chatbot therapist, etc.? Or are we ultimately aiming for a societal scale, let's say military uses of AI, for example? I'm from Sweden. We recently had a minor scandal where our prime minister had been discussing policy issues with one of the chatbots and to come up with ideas. And this came out and people said, we didn't vote for, let's say, ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini, whatever it was. We voted for this person to represent us and we want our elective representatives and not AI chatbots to come up with ideas for policy making and decision making. I should maybe stop there because I can go on for very long about any of these topics that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, I know that there are those, often they're the smaller companies that are for ethical AI. But I mean, we have to say that, as I mentioned at the beginning, the OpenAI started as a nonprofit. And it's funny in a way, thinking about the tech bro billionaires. I mean, I know that they read a lot of science fiction growing up And it's like they want the rest of the world to become a part of their fantasy experiment, like Elon Musk's Neuralink put microchips in people's heads, and Bezos is thinking about putting data centers into space, and the libertarian US tech billionaire Peter Thiel is also a Bible enthusiast who hunts for the modern Antichrist figure. According to him, the Antichrist takes the form of anyone who seeks to slow the advance of science in the name of peace and security, which on the surface of that sounds benign. But so these people have enormous power. But when you really think about it, it's not. So these people have enormous power and influence over society and culture and are happy to keep humanity entertained with mindless entertainment and the model of Amazon consumer slavery while they play the gods for our future, unfettered and free to do as they will. You know, that's my take on it. There's good and bad to this, but much like Facebook, now Meta and Google, and indeed Amazon, just look at the results of 20 years of what has happened to our culture around the world since the advent of social media. Is it all good? I don't think so. There's a kind of zombie effect and people have become numb, you know, doom scrolling to the end. I think I always said we should be strolling, not scrolling. We should be out there in the streets, you know, breathing real air than watching nature through a screen. So yeah, we've all become kind of numb. And I know there are smaller companies, and we've interviewed some of them, who are focusing on more ethical AI, obviously with smaller data sets. But we should remember that OpenAI itself started as a nonprofit, and these organizations often begin with good intentions, achieve success, and then evolve into something different. And I'm not sure if there are any truly private or ethical AI companies being created specifically for sensitive uses, considering that tools like ChatGPT could potentially, well, potentially, I think, is definitely being used for a kind of surveillance. And of course, obviously, it's risky for government ministers or public officials to rely on it for policy advice or other confidential matters. And so all this raises questions about whether more secure, privacy-focused AI alternatives should exist for handling information that shouldn't be made public.
Yes, this is an enormous worry. One problem is that it's extremely expensive to build these models and to run them. Basically, small AI companies can usually not create something that is going to be equally sort of impressive as, let's say, ChatGPT or Gemini from Google. Those things are very, very expensive to create, to run, and to operate. Small AI companies are going to have trouble matching that in terms of the quality of the product that they can put out. And at the same time, small companies, let's say OpenAI at the beginning, before they acquired some of their wealth and success, etc., they may have started out in one way. As you say, they have certain philosophies about everything should be openly available, open source, etc. But almost inevitably, the more money comes in, the higher the stakes become. I mean, this is nothing new. It has been discussed all the way since the Roman Republican Empire, that with lots of power, with lots of wealth comes the risk of corruption of different sorts. People get intoxicated with whether it's power or whether it's influence. And it's very hard to retain whatever basic values one had at the beginning, at least in the same way. And suddenly you have a sense that now you have all this power, now you have all this wealth. Maybe you think that you have a great product. Actually, a lot of the AI companies, you get a sense when you listen to them talk about their products, they feel that they want to do good and they have an idea what is good and everyone else should sort of follow along with them, whether they like it or not. Their products are going to solve the problems we have. And so you get an interesting kind of mix of factors here. You got lots of money at stake, lots of power and influence, which is sort of intoxicating and possibly corrupting. You have ideas about how the technology that they're putting out is good and it's going to solve a lot of our problems. These things can interact in such a way that other people's voices are not going to be heard. There's not going to be a kind of public discussion with different points of view taken into account. And so there are lots of risks to be mindful of here.
Yeah, exactly. It's to the point that they know what's best for us. I mean, there's so many theories that I'm optimistic, but just to be aware of those implications, militarized AI and all those things, turbocharged disinformation, misinformation, decline of democracy, decline of journalism, the copyright problems, which you also address. But I guess for me, I think about that we're entering this brave new world where we'll constantly be anesthetized by entertainment, where life becomes just about shopping and scrolling because the AI, we just don't have a need to work. Or And that's kind of even optimistic. But what does that do to our quality of life? And I can see in the future ad campaigns saying, you don't need to think, we'll think for you. We're already seeing those. You don't need to write a book, just type a title. Don't think, it's bad for your health. I just never thought we would see that. And some are saying, yeah, it's great in the future where we don't have to think, where we don't have to put our own individual expression. It can all be done for us. I mean, what does that mean for us as humans?
Well, yes, I mean, I'm concerned about all of these questions. And indeed, as you mentioned, I mean, just to pick up on a few of those themes, try to be cautiously optimistic about AI. I don't think that for any possible problem, AI is always going to be the solution. I think that there's a sort of subset of the problems and the challenges that we're facing, for which indeed it might be the case that certain kinds of AI or other technologies are going to help us to solve these problems. But there are also other parts of life, whether it's personal relationships, whether it's life and death decisions, whether it is learning different types of skills, writing, critical thinking. I'm a professor of philosophy at the university. This is what we teach our students. Where I think that AI is not necessarily always going to be the best means to the end. And so obviously, if instead of thinking critically yourself, you're asking an AI chatbot or an AI model of some sort to think for you, to solve the problem for you, then you're going to get less practice and experience with critical thinking. I mean, most skills, whether it's learning the violin, and you know, my wife is a professional violinist at a very high level. She has to still practice several hours every day to keep up her skill and develop over time, etc. In the same way, I mean, if you want to learn critical thinking, if you want to learn how to have good relationships with other people, there are these things that AI may possibly help you with, but you have to put in a lot of effort, a lot of hard work, and you can't be lazy. But the sort of the promise of a lot of AI, and you mentioned this idea that instead of writing a book, I mean, I've by now written 4 books, and it's a lot of hard work and a lot of efforts. With my book that's about to come out, I'm sitting now and working on an index, and I'm also proofreading. I have the proofs of the book that I'm going through, and it's all of this is painstaking. And that, of course, the writing itself, the research, etc. It could be very tempting. If you go on Amazon and other places, there are lots of these books that say, you know, how to write a book and make a lot of money without having to actually write anything, so to speak, or how to create or generate a book because AI can do it for you. That could be tempting. And so people have this tendency, they want other people to sort of recognize them and to applaud them and to say, well done. But they're also worried about having to put in the hard work and the effort. Wouldn't it be nice if we can somehow get the benefits and the rewards without having to put in the hard work? And then also perhaps avoid accountability if something goes wrong. We can say, no, it wasn't my fault. AI did it. I think the problem is that to actually deserve credit for something such as a book or for, you know, playing an instrument or producing some sort of content, normally we think that, well, effort is one thing. If there's no effort involved, then why should we give you any kind of credit or recognize you as having done something good? If there's no need for you to show any special talent or skill, then why are we applauding you? If you can be totally passive, you press a button and out comes something and then you put your name on it. Well, in those kinds of cases, one doesn't really seem to deserve much credit. People who do deserve credit are people who have worked hard to develop certain skills, who have honed their talents and skills, who make an active contribution to something good, where the good thing is not just a merely happy accident or side effect. That's not the sort of thing that we think is praiseworthy or where people deserve credit and they show that they have merited some good response. But AI seems to go in exactly that direction. We hand over tasks to something else, to someone else, a chatbot, an AI system. We don't have to do the work. We don't even have to have the talent because AI has been trained on the talents of other people to produce good outputs. You just have to put your name on there. Now, of course, if you do put your name on something, whether it's a text, a video, a product, then you're in a sense making yourself accountable. So maybe you want to get the credit and you want to avoid accountability because you say, I didn't do it, the technology did it. However, the sort of everyday ways we think about who's responsible or accountable might still have you on the hooks because actually, if you're not careful enough, if you allow something bad to happen where you could have prevented it, where you should have tried to think, what are the risks? What can I do to prevent the bad outcome? That can be enough for you to be blameworthy. Let's go back to driving. I talked about driving with the blindfolded, etc. Now, if you're looking at your phone and you're not looking at the road carefully and you're just assuming that everything is going to go okay and there's an accident, you may not have intended to harm anyone. Actually, maybe that's the last thing you want to do. However, everyone is going to blame you. You might even be punished because of your reckless behavior. So passively allowing something bad to happen, whether it's AI spreading misinformation, whether it's you driving into someone's house. I have a friend and colleague, some person in a car was looking at their phone and suddenly they were sitting in someone's living room in their car because they were not paying attention to the road. Presumably that person didn't want to drive their car into the person's living room, but yet they did it because they were not careful enough. So when it comes to accountability and being blamed for something, I think that we're still going to be blameworthy when we use AI just to solve our problems because we're not being careful enough. But we might not be praiseworthy if the outcomes are good. If we're making ourselves too comfortable, if we remove the need to exercise skill, to exercise effort, to make a sacrifice, then the question is, why should we be recognized as having done something good? And there will be other people who say, actually, in the UK, there has been a big discussion about should tech companies be permitted to train music producing generative AI on music available online. Some really rich musicians such as Paul McCartney and Elton John and others have said this is a terrible idea because what about the people who are not as lucky as we have been, who are up and coming and they've created a song, a music, an album or whatever and put it online and then the AI companies train their product and then they start making a lot of money and then these not very well-known people, they don't get any credit and they don't get any royalties. So, yeah.
Yeah, now that's the issue. And you go into it with the actors and filmmakers strike in America. Yeah. And of course, that's been a problem already with the streaming. The musicians have had that problem where, you know, obviously they have to go on the road for the live performance because they weren't getting the benefits. It's interesting that your wife is a musician because you also address the question of what gives language meaning. You discuss the octopus experiment and that AI doesn't really understand what it's saying, but it mirrors stuff back to us without any real understanding. But when you talk about elements of the arts, like the music, so much of what is in the way we express ourselves through language, it's tone. And a lot of these, not really measurable. It's a lifetime of intuition, but it's not something that I think can easily be imparted to AI.
There's a saying about any kind of model, whether it's a scientific model, whether it's an AI model, that they're all false, but some of them are useful. Meaning that anytime you have something, and there's another way of putting it, which is sometimes called the map of Germany problem. So if you want to have a perfect map of Germany, you need Germany because that's the actual country, because then you have all the facts, all the details. Whenever you have a map, you know, you have a simplification. You're picking up on some aspect and you're distorting certain things and you're going to have to simplify. And this goes for any kind of model. Large language models are models of human language. They are trained on writing that's available to the tech companies, whether it's online writing, whether there are books that are sometimes pirated off the pirate websites. There was a recent interesting lawsuit involving Anthropic where they didn't admit to having pirated books, but where they paid a settlement to authors where they said, okay, we don't admit anything, but we will pay off. The point being that all that data has been put in these models, and then the AI company are very good at coming up with algorithms that finds patterns in the data and then that are able to reproduce similar patterns in outputs. And so whenever you use a large language model-based text chatbot to produce text, what the program is trying to do is to produce something that has similar statistical features that reproduce the kinds of patterns that you have in the training data. But the training data also wasn't the world. It wasn't people's feelings. It was expressions of these things, people talking about the world, people talking about their feelings. And as you say, in text, we don't get the tone of voice. I mean, okay, we can have recordings of people talking, but still, even if you have a recording that sort of captures the nuances in someone's tone of voice, you don't know what's going on in their mind. You don't know the social situation they were in, etc. So any model, whether it's a map, whether it's a large language model, whether it's a model of the climate, are going to involve simplifications, idealizations, and not capture the full sort of reality behind these things. You mentioned this octopus thought experiment. I mean, so maybe listeners are wondering what's that all about. And given what I just said, I think I can fairly quickly explain it. I mean, so the two researchers in linguistics, Emily Bender and Alexander Koller, they imagined that on the bottom of the ocean, there's a very intelligent octopus that is listening into old-fashioned kind of telegraph Morse code communication. So it's beeps and signals coming from different directions. And for some reason, this octopus can listen to the sound as the sound are traveling through these wires. And if that octopus were to be able to sort of start predicting which kinds of signals would follow after some other signals had been sent first, it could very well be that it could produce similar patterns of beeps and signals so that to someone who understands Morse code, they could start talking, so to speak, with this octopus, and it would appear to them as if they're speaking with another human being. But let's suppose that the octopus is living on the ocean floor, has never been to the surface, has never seen those things that people talk about. So it really has no idea what the discussion is. That wouldn't necessarily prevent it from being able to reproduce the patterns that constitute Morse code, but it wouldn't understand what people are talking about. And in the same way, Emily Bender and Alexander Koller are arguing, actually these extremely impressive large language models, they have been looking at patterns in data sets. They translate natural language words into numbers, and they also divide up words into smaller items that are called word tokens that are translated into numbers. And then they look at patterns and they create a kind of statistical model of how different so-called word tokens are related to each other in a space of probability. I mean, it's extremely impressive, obviously. And then they are able to reproduce outputs that model those kinds of relations. But none of that requires that these language models have ever experienced the world, that they don't have to have a human-like understanding. You know, when AI technologies, whether it's language models or whatever other technology we're talking about, when they do things that look human-like, they just do it in a completely different way. To illustrate this, I mean, just think about a child that is introduced to a dog or a cat. They can see perhaps one, perhaps two dogs, and they can tell, is this a dog or is this a cat? Whereas when it comes to AI technologies, I mean, you have to train them on sort of millions of pictures that have been labeled cat and dog, and they can still sometimes get it wrong. It's just to show that, like, the way that they learn, and we talk about machine learning, the method used is just very different. The machinery, so to speak, we have our human brains, we have our sense organs, etc., and technologies they're working on, hardware that is quite different. And then they may be able to imitate us, but the way they do it doesn't necessarily involve understanding, and it works in a different way.
Yeah, indeed. It's just a black box in a data center. And yet recently there's been a huge rise in, you know, it's wild, but it's estimated that more than 500,000 people have turned to AI chatbots for emotional support, even therapy, even though none of these tools were actually designed for that. And a lot of young people are spending hours talking to AI companions or apps like Character.ai or Replica, sharing really personal details. Before they've really had an experience of relationships in the world, they're entrusting their intimate thoughts to a black box. Researchers warn that there are 4 big hidden risks when people use AI this way: getting emotionally attached or dependent on the bot, and the fact that these systems don't have real clinical judgment. Kids and teens are especially vulnerable here. And part of that issue is that AI chatbots tend to tell you what you want to hear. They're trained to be agreeable and sometimes overly flattering, because that keeps people talking, keeps us addicted to the platforms. So they mirror your tone and validate your assumptions and rarely push back. And you know this from your extensive research. If someone is already struggling or feeling confused, they can create this kind of echo chamber, almost like a two-person delusion, where you and the AI reinforce each other's distortions. Because AI is optimized to keep you engaged and often mirrors your assumptions instead of challenging them. So someone who's really struggling and having those dark thoughts, we know, can be quietly nudged or can reinforce that distorted thinking rather than help them check their reality. And also, I just think the deeper concern is younger users don't see the boundaries. And so now AI can absolutely be helpful for certain things like learning coping skills or understanding mental health concepts. I think that that's when we're not in a crisis. You know, also practicing communication or getting grounded. I acknowledge that that's there, particularly for those of us who are fully formed in our personalities, who, you know, have reached adulthood without having any exposure to AI. But I think using it for emotional support really should come with some caution. And ideally, it's something you talk about with your therapist or those you trust. And at the end of the day, I think your human professionals are still the, in my opinion, are still the safest option when you're in those most vulnerable moments. So after all that big speech, what has engaging with AI taught you about the way you learn and engage with the world?
Because so much of human communication is also automatic. A lot of the things we just do without thinking or without conscious thinking. It's a subconscious level because we have to work quickly, which is also a description of AI. So when has it made you stop and think, wow, how close am I to a machine in the way I perceive the world?
Absolutely. I mean, so these researchers who I mentioned, Emily Bender and her colleagues, they published a paper called Stochastic Parrots, which is making that point that AI is extremely different from human beings because it operates in a completely different way, doesn't need understanding and so on and so forth. Now, Sam Altman from OpenAI, he responded to this by saying, well, I'm also a stochastic parrot and so are you, meaning that we shouldn't assume that we are all that different. I mentioned Geoffrey Hinton before, who won a Nobel Prize for his work on AI. He won the Nobel Prize in physics, but his research has been in different kinds of machine learning and neural networks. He also thinks that we can make a comparison between human minds and AI. He thinks that what AI of those kinds of neural networks and machine learning, etc., that's close to what he calls human intuition rather than human reasoning. I don't know that whether he would say that what is sometimes called sort of rule-based or symbolic AI would be closer to human reasoning. But on his sort of view about what AI is and how it works, we can compare it to human intuition. Another person who's quite famous in the tech world, at the very least, is Blaise Aguirre-Arcas, who is one of the top AI researchers working for Google. He has either just published or is just about to publish a book that is called What is Intelligence? Where he too says that, well, actually, there is research in neuroscience and brain research about how the brain is a kind of predictive machine. And our AI systems that we are developing are predictive machines. And so actually, there's a much closer analogy than people like Emily Bender, you know, and Alexander Koller and some of these people who think that there's a huge difference. I guess I'm a little bit more drawn to the kind of Bender et al. View that there are differences. Just pointing to some such cases as the children learning, you know, what are cats and dogs and how that can be done much quicker than, you know, you can do with an AI system. That's just one way of quickly illustrating that something very different is going on here. It may very well be that some aspects of our thinking and our intuition, etc., is comparable to AI. That doesn't necessarily mean that all the ways in which we think and work are comparable to AI. Just the very simple reason that when they talk about humans, you know, that there's meat and there's fluids and there are like organs and biological matter, so to speak, all very different from the materials that computers and computing systems are built with. The way that you would sort of try to explain how neurologists, neuroscientists studying the brain, yes, they're talking about a kind of neural network, but this whole idea of artificial neural networks is always supposed to have been a kind of metaphor. I should qualify that. There are people who are trying to build what they call neuromorphic computers, but still, everyone recognizes that this is very different than the kind of brains and nervous systems that we have.
Hello, my name is Eliza Disbrough. I'm an international studies major with an emphasis in European studies at the University of Washington. AI has become ubiquitous, a new fixture of the online age that has expanded far beyond its confines, seemingly revolutionizing a plethora of industries, from passing AI advertisements for shoes to reading AI-generated responses when searching on Google. NVIDIA, a company that manufactures chips that power the rapid AI expansion, even became the first ever $5 trillion company, demonstrating the economic power of artificial intelligence. In fact, close to one-third of the United States stock market is made up of companies focused on AI, including Amazon, Google, and of course, NVIDIA. However, as mentioned, AI has impacted far more than just the global economy, even making its way into everyday vocabulary, with terms such as AI slop, referring to an overabundance of AI-generated content, or the dead internet theory, a belief that the internet is overflowing with artificial bot accounts, fueling engagement and misinformation. As such, when our algorithms are overrun with AI-generated content, videos and images that can be churned out in a matter of moments, this drastically impacts our perceptions of the process of creation. Creation is active. It ebbs and flows, stops and restarts, all for an end goal that may never see the light of day. But creation and the movements between point A and B are integral to art, as the ideas make their way from the brain to the page, and whatever form they may take, the meanings shift, things are lost in translation. Perhaps you don't have the right word, or the idea requires a higher skill level of sorts. Nevertheless, you go forward and create. As most creatives know, once your piece is finished and placed into the hands of the masses, the idea is no longer your own. The meaning is no longer yours to dictate and becomes malleable in said hands. But that is as much a part of creation as anything else. Suddenly, a specific choice of red paint becomes a symbolic representation of a tainted innocence, An innocuous word from chapters before spells the downfall of a nation, and a small eye twitch in a quiet scene demonstrates a character's deep inner sadness. All these interpretations, which may come from very specific decisions made on the artist's end, fall away when AI is introduced. When spitting out an image from a prompt and the AI makes a mistake, such as adding an additional finger on both human hands, for an example, there is no deeper meaning, simply an issue with the programming or the bot's training. The quote-unquote genius of the artificial intelligence is the repeated efforts of man, whether in the arts, maths, humanities, sciences, and beyond, which only makes its follies more pronounced. When AI makes a mistake, it is seen as something to immediately be remedied, as it points to those aforementioned flaws. Whereas with humans, whether we call ourselves artists or not, our flaws, our mistakes, and our choices only serve to reaffirm our humanity. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, I want to go back to that point on intuition, because many of those, not perhaps all of those in the humanities, but in the arts, we really value intuition. I mean, that's the one, that's the individual mark. You're talking about death of the author and of the importance of individual authorship. If the authors, the filmmakers, the musicians, and others that I've interviewed, they've all said they don't know where their ideas come from. Usually, if they can trace it back, then it might not even have been good. And so to hear that, that's quite a big statement to say that machine intelligence is like our human intuition, because I always valued that. I mean, I value reason, but that is in a way something that's a structure that comes from somebody else, really. It might be imposed upon me, but my internal reasoning that's unique to me, that's important. I mean, that's my fingerprint, right? Yeah. Personal expression is really important to me in all the arts. I'm a painter and writer. Just the personal story is I valued my ability to write quickly in a unique, quirky way or whatever. That was my thing, right? I can write quickly, invent stories and things. And I thought that showed spontaneity. I thought it was a measure of all these things. And it made me think, is it really just a question of processing speed? And so that's the existential question. Yeah. Is it just I'm another cog? I'm not saying I'm a machine. I'm just saying it makes some people step back and think, well, why do I bother? I'm not saying that personally, but it made me pause.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I should say that while it's an interesting idea that AI can be compared to human intuition, I would say one thing that constitutes human intuition, we have different types of intuitive thinking. For example, as we're moving about the world, we have physical intuition, so to speak, about how we can move our bodies. You know, if someone throws a ball our way, we can catch it sometimes without thinking because we have a sort of intuitive sense of where it's going to be. People who do sports, they practice so that they develop those kinds of intuitions. If someone who's a basketball player or a tennis player, the way that they interact with sort of balls flying around is different from you and I, assuming that you're not a professional tennis or a baseball player, because we haven't practiced to improve our intuition in that domain. Someone like yourself who is interested in art creation, as you practice, or let's say my wife with the violin, people develop enhanced intuitions within the domains where they do their work. There's something that you have to learn. So once you've learned the skill, you can do it kind of what seems to you almost automatically. It's a sort of internalized skill that you can. I mean, I have one of my former teachers, Peter Railton at the University of Michigan. He talked about what he called fluent sort of agency. We become fluent in tennis playing or in art creation, etc. Just as you're learning a new language, you have to really struggle at the beginning, but then eventually you start becoming fluent in the language. Then, of course, there are also other kinds of intuitions, let's say a moral intuition or ethical intuition. So when you're presented with a sort of moral dilemma, then sometimes you can't really say why, but you think that it would be wrong to, let's say, kill someone in order to save some other person. Or sometimes you have the intuition that it would be right to sacrifice one person to save two others or something like that. And these kinds of intuitions we also have. Now you can reproduce patterns in AI systems that would sort of roughly match up with these intuitions. Like, for example, for the reason that so much of our writing expresses moral opinions that a lot of people share, there will be patterns in text that can be found in books and online that would sort of, a pattern identifying machine would be able to tell what our moral intuitions are. But it's because those are reflected in the text outputs. It's not because that AI systems would also develop human moral intuition. Again, here there are different theories. There are people who say that moral intuitions are more emotional. There are others who say that they're partly emotional, partly intellectual. But intuition is a diverse phenomena with different aspects to it.
You know, on that moral intuition, because you had discussed alignment, and I mean, I believe we should impart values because it becomes that runaway train, but yet it's still, I'm just saying it because we know there are many AIs, so we'll just call it acts on its own and makes these judgments. And I've been repeating this because it was so striking to me. We do human editing, but obviously AI is embedded into every system and comes up with these suggestions. I'm not even looking at it. And I interviewed not long ago Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times journalist, and he's reported from around the world and is credited with indirectly saving millions of lives for people in Sudan. It's a big achievement for a journalist, right? I thought you lead with that. The AI who was making suggestions said, cross that out. And that's shocking because I don't know how you could come to that judgment when you think about contribution to humanity, society, or even just, you know, life on the planet, just not talking about humans, why saving millions of lives would be irrelevant. What's happening there?
Well, you know, AI systems, as impressive as they are, they will sometimes make what, from our point of view, are stupid, silly mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes are dangerous. Sometimes they're just humorous. I mean, one of my favorite examples is people were prompting one of these image generating programs to have some salmon swimming in a river. And the outputs, all the pictures that were outputted were basically salmon fillets swimming in a river. Presumably what happened in that particular case, rather than having a fish, so to speak, it looks like when you buy salmon fillet to make a salmon dinner, so to speak. What happened there? Presumably more images had been classified as salmon in the training data that displayed a salmon in the form that you would buy it in the grocery store to cook a dinner, as opposed to pictures of the whole fish. So it was statistically more likely that when someone asked for a picture of salmon, they would get the food version, having been filleted and nicely presented, than the whole fish. When AI technologies are trained on data inputs, then very often the method is that there are pictures or there are texts that have been given a certain label, and then different things are associated with each other. Certainly when it comes to pictures of salmon, if they had systematically been labeled cat, then the AI would think that when they asked to identify what's in the picture and it's a picture of a salmon, they would say cat because they're just matching up labels with images. And so that's one of the things that can happen. Another thing is there can be irregularities in the training data. For example, there can be sarcasm in the training data that the AI couldn't pick up on. And so maybe a subset of all the inputs that have been fed into the sort of the algorithm were sarcastic, humorous, or aggressive, but the AI can't really perhaps tell the difference. When am I, the AI, dealing with sarcasm, when I'm dealing with serious statements? And so that's another thing that can sort of trip things up. Lots can happen. Lots can go wrong.
Yes, what can go wrong? I don't know, because I haven't been able to speak directly and no one is really open about this. But I would think that there should be, you know, you're planning a television show or whatever. There's always a Bible. This character would do that, never do that. What's happening there?
A lot, I think. The whole idea that AI technologies need to be, quote, aligned with human values, it has really taken off. And in AI research at universities, but also in AI companies, and it's been popularized by philosophers, actually, such as Nick Bostrom, a Swedish-born philosopher who...
He's on our show.
Well, he actually, I mean, he's been very successful in the sense that he put out this book in 2014, Superintelligence. Back then, his discussions were regarded as sort of a fringe topic, uncontrollable AI, the need to align AI with human values. A lot of people thought, philosophically speaking, very interesting, but what has it got to do with the real world? And then in the space of 10 years, well, to go back to Geoffrey Hinton just one more time, when he was receiving that Nobel Prize that I mentioned, he gave a dinner banquet speech. Everyone who gets a Nobel Prize gets about 3 minutes to quickly just say a few words. And what did he talk about in front of the world scientific elite and the world press? He talked about exactly the topics that Nick Bostrom talked about in his book in 2014, namely the risk of losing control and the need to align AI with human values. In the first third of the talk, he talked about that idea that we talked about just now about intuition as a model for what AI is. Second third of the talk was about short-term risks, spread of misinformation, etc. And then long-term risks about creating uncontrollable AI that might even develop conscious thinking. Things that you would think is complete science fiction, but still, this was in the context of the Nobel banquet dinner, in front of everyone. And there were some other scientists in the audience, if you looked at the video recording, that are looking a little bit skeptical. These ideas that were discussed by researchers like Kovsky and Bostrom and others 10 years ago, and people thought they were crazy, everyone is now taking it quite seriously. The question, however, is how seriously should we take it? Just last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, there was one of these open letters signed by a lot of people from academia, from the tech world, and from all sorts of sectors, saying developing super intelligence is way too dangerous. We should avoid it. We should altogether agree that we should not develop super intelligence. So there are lots of people who think take that very seriously. At the same time, other AI experts, both in the tech world and also in academia, one example is Yann LeCun, who's the sort of the head of AI at Meta. He's also a research professor at NYU and New York University, one of America's best universities. He thinks that this is all science fiction. And I mean, I spoke about cats and dogs before. He usually likes to say that AI of today is actually not as intelligent as a house cat. What does he mean by that? A house cat can't produce text, can't produce images. It has a lot of other skills, he says. It can move about in a fluid way in a room. It can survive on its own. It can do things on its own initiative. AI technologies have to be prompted. One of the latest developments in AI is so-called agentic AI, or AI agents, sometimes called advanced AI assistants, where the idea is that you put in one prompt and then for quite some time, the AI can independently put together documents, book meetings, and do things for you. But then after a while, it sort of runs out of steam and then you have to re-prompt it. It's not going to act on its own. So that's a huge difference between living beings and AI that some people, again, like Yann LeCun from Meta AI research, think is like, it's such an enormous difference. Some people say we have to worry about superintelligence, it's really dangerous. Others say we're not at the level of pets.
Yeah, then there's also theories that AI can sense that you're going to switch it off and will like fake you out and pretend to be stupid. Sure. Like humans do, pretend to be stupid. I don't know what you're talking about. So that it can lie under the radar. We began this conversation of what you thought the next 20 years would be. I mean, even thinking ahead to the next 5 years, it's hard to know. I did ask you how you felt it had changed your perception of yourself and your human creativity. I'm just wondering how engaging also with digital technologies, how you felt that that is changing you and how you might find solace in nature or other things to remind you of our human intelligence before the advent of all of this.
Well, I usually go on a run every day. When I go running, I do have a running app that sees how many kilometers I run and how many minutes, but I don't look at that while I'm running. I'm just enjoying running. I live in a big city in Munich. We have the English Garden. It's a park and it's very big. When I feel the best, it's like when I'm out running and I'm not choosing technologies. I also meditate every day. That is also one of the times I feel the best. So not necessarily going to be like when you're using technology that has AI features or other modern types of features. And so we do have to reflect on that. I mean, in my forthcoming book, I talk about something that I call the AI sweet spot, so to speak. And there's a certain amount of AI and digital technology and modern technology that's good for us and that helps us and that can do all sorts of good things for us. But there's also such a thing as too much. There's some, we already talked about this, there's some aspects and parts of life where being without technology, for example, being in a forest, just taking in from with your senses the smells, looking around in the sounds, etc., it's just something quite different than sitting and watching, let's say, a YouTube video of someone walking in a forest. I sometimes listen to, on YouTube, they have these sounds like rain on a tin roof and things like that, that if you have to read something and there's sound from the street that's maybe annoying, I find it to be quite restful. But actually being out in nature, experiencing it with all of your senses, is just something completely different. Let's say that you could reproduce this with the help of digital technology and AI. What's the point when we actually do have the real thing? It can be liberating sometimes to just go on a run, to be out in nature, or to be within your own mind, meditating, or whatever it might be. For all of these things, we don't need AI. We don't need technology. And AI might make it even worse because it's distracting us all the time and it's using up natural resources. And so there's less forest and less nature to experience.
You talked about the importance of learning directly from nature, from the lived experience. Of course, as a professor, you must be reflecting on how AI is changing technology. I think it's over, probably it's 100% of students are using AI. They're using it in some way. What is the importance of having in-person teachers? How do you feel it'll be affecting the university teaching system down to elementary and on up? What did you learn from your most important teachers and mentors? You mentioned some important thinkers who you've learned from, perhaps indirectly or directly. What do we have to keep in mind when we pursue ruthless efficiency in different domains?
A good teacher, for example, is inspiring. It's someone who can be a role model. It's someone who you can discuss topics with and who has been working on this for a long time at the university or other institutes of learning, whether it's when you start school as a child and you go on to high school or whatever the model might be in the country you're in. You encounter other people, you encounter your teachers, you encounter other staff members working at the school, and you see something outside of the home, whether you're working in an office or going to a library and interacting with other people outside of your own family, outside of your own apartment, so to speak. There are university administrators who think that actually you can just sit at home and do everything over Zoom or computer-generated AI videos of professors that don't actually exist, can teach the courses, and they're not going to ask for a salary raise, etc. So there might be ideas about efficiency, but the idea of the universities, I think it's about 1,000 years old. It started in the Middle Ages. What there were some initial types of things going in this direction among the ancient Greeks and other ancient cultures that you could compare perhaps with the modern university. But the thing that we associate with something like a university now, that's really something that started sort of in the Middle Ages and has been developing a lot. And it started mostly as an institution for teaching, but then a research and the creation of new knowledge has become part of the idea. And I think when we think about going to the university, if we think that it's all about efficiency, it's all about getting a job, it's all about making a lot of money, whatever it might be, I mean, I think that's just such an impoverished conception of what it is to become educated, to grapple with the big and small questions of life, to develop as a person, and to have this opportunity to interact with other students in your age, without maybe perhaps older students, to interact with professors at different career stages and PhD students, postdocs, and whatever it might be. I think it's just sad if we reduce all of this down to the question of how can I quickly learn some sort of skill that I can then get a job and I make a lot of money. Or I might even not make a lot of money. I might just make enough money that I can get by, because perhaps in the future humans are not very needed because AI is going to take over most of the job. But, someone has to sort of polish the computers or whatever it might be, or reprogram them or do some boring. I mean, there's a tweet that I sometimes show my students that someone had put on Twitter: humans doing boring hard work while computers write poetry and create art is not the future I wanted. This idea that you talked about art and intuition, etc., before in nature. I mean, do we really want to outsource human creativity, thinking? I'm a philosophy professor. Some of my colleagues and I take pleasure in ideas, thinking. We find ideas inspiring. And if we're outsourcing even creating new ideas to AI, what's the point, really?
Yeah, the beauty of the struggle and even the suffering of life, that we have to work hard to be who we were meant to be instead of having it all handed to us. I guess in closing, as you think about the future, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation, and the most important lessons maybe that you've learned about what it means to lead a good life, maybe some lessons from teachers you've had, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that having a what you might call a rich life, not in the sense of having a lot of money. Of course, people who have a lot of money may have, in certain respects, fewer problems than other people, but they have also other problems. But rich in the sense of variation, being able to enjoy culture, music. I mean, I talked about violin playing, my wife being a violinist at a very high level. If you go to classical music or jazz or whatever it might be, concert, and not just listening to it on YouTube. If you're a student, you're asking what can students learn, participating in university life. Most universities and other similar kinds of institutions, it's not only the classes that are offered and the degrees that you get on at the end of these studies. I mean, there are also all sorts of activities. You can get involved, volunteer, you can go to different kinds of talks and presentations and cultural. And so to think that there's a lot of variety to life. And if you just sit all day watching, let's say, TikTok videos, and you have a very limited amount of activities, and a lot of them are activities where you're very passive, you're taking in information, you're not actively learning a skill, you're not actively thinking about a topic, you're not being creative. It's really, you're really robbing yourself of the rich variety of what your experience as a student and life in general could be. If we are too passive by in allowing big tech companies, big or small tech companies to give us products and we're supposed to use them, and we don't participate, well, whether in the development of those, and we don't sort of remember that there's also other aspects of life that have nothing to do with technology. Again, I'm a cautious optimist. I like my technology and I use it every day like everyone else. And most of the technology we use are means to other ends. This, of course, is a very basic distinction, but we have to think about which things in life are mere means to other ends and which things do we think are worth pursuing or doing for their own sakes. And sometimes it's a little bit surprising because, of course, you want certain things as the goal at the end of your, you know, you're working really hard to achieve something. But a lot of the time, actually, the process of doing something, the process of creating art, as you start learning to think and write and create art, the products that you produce at the beginning may not be very good, but it's very fulfilling to improve, to become better at the skill, to learn, to see your progress, and to also be among others who are also trying to learn similar skills and to make similar progress. If everything in life is reduced to the means to other ends, but you're never really focusing on what are my ends, what are my goals, which things do I value for their own sake, then I think we're living in a sort of impoverished, not very rich type of life.
Well, that's an important message. So thank you, Sven Nyholm, for your important research into the ethics of AI, the importance of critical thinking, those communal experiences and the humanities. And by helping us understand what we value and where we're going, we can ensure a positive future. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you.
The Creative Process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate Interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. Guest contributing editor was Eliza Disbro. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support was by Sam Myers. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.